Okay, we'll get going. As we're talking about Van Til and his relationship, Bonson and his relationship to Van Til, let me ride a little bit of a hobby horse right here. There's an old saying by, I think it was Lloyd Benston, in his debate with Dan Quayle. When Dan Quayle said something about John F. Kennedy, he said, "I knew John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy was a good friend of mine. Mr. Quayle, you're no John F. Kennedy." And that got a lot of chuckles, right? Well, kind of going off of that, Bonson is, his name is used by a lot of people these days, and I think most people in this room, and hopefully most people that are hearing this, know this, but it's always good to say things like this for historical purposes. Greg Bonson I knew pretty well, and I know that some of the things that some of his followers claim about him are not true. Many people say he would be involved in the federal visionary stuff, in Pato Communion. That stuff is totally false. Bonson had no affinity for those types of views. Now, the federal vision wasn't really much on the radar there, but he held a confessional view of justification. He wrote about it, defended it, preached on it. And as far as his view on communion for young children, he didn't write anything on it that I know of. I think he, in a few tapes, he may have alluded to something about it, but he didn't write anything about it because some of his friends were getting into it. And if you know something about Greg Bonson, you know that there was a lot of people that, for various reasons, became his enemies. And he was a very loyal man. And he didn't want to. He did enough, he thought, that his friends, he was not afraid to confront them, but he just didn't want to do one more thing that would offend his friends that he was loyal to and that they were loyal to him. So I know that he fed, I won't say who it was, he fed a lot of information, his own studies and research, to some other theologian that if I said his name, you'd recognize him, to do an article or a book against Pato Communion. Okay, now somebody who is feeding information to a fellow scholar about refuting Pato Communion obviously doesn't have affinities for Pato Communion. So the legacy of Greg Bonson is somewhat, I think, besmirched by some of the confusions out there that some of the people that claim to represent him. Now, in his last sermon, which was, I'll always remember, I was there, for no other reason than he wore his best suit. If you knew him, he had a taste for nice clothes, and he wore his best suit. He talked about John Donne, and John Donne wore his funeral attire for his last sermon. And Greg said, he mentioned John Donne, he says, "Well, this isn't my funeral attire," but it turned out he was wearing it. I think he knew that that may very well be, and probably did know that that was his last sermon. But in that last sermon, he made it clear that we are not to go around saying, "Greg Bonson said this." And so I don't want to sound like I'm doing this. You know, "Greg Bonson said this." But I do think we should set the record straight on occasion. And let's set the record straight on this stuff. Greg had no affinities to some of the things that you hear people claim he had affinities to. Okay, now back to the topic at hand. Another way that Bonson improved upon Van Til was his organizing and explaining the presuppositional method. Many of us have read Van Til, and now I read him with pleasure, but he's a bit difficult going without certain philosophical training, and he is sometimes disorganized. Van Til, though he was a very systemic thinker, he wasn't always the most seemingly organized writer. And he wasn't the best writer of the English language. Dutch was his native language, and he had an odd English idiom. And so sometimes some of his expressions were odd as well. So another improvement that Greg made on Van Til is to explain him in a more, I think, orderly manner, at least pedagogically easier to understand, cleaned up some of the language, explained it in a way that you didn't have to have a great deal of philosophical background. In fact, one of the great things about Greg Bonson, one of the things I admired him most for, was he is a man of great intellect and great learning, and yet it never ceased to amaze me how he was able to take things and present them to the church and have everybody understand it. He's really gifted at that. And so that was one of the great abilities that he possessed. And in this case, organizing Van Til, explaining him, writing on the same topics, but from a different way that is, for most of us, clearer, was a great boon to presuppositional apologetics. Finally, in the essay, I mentioned that he goes beyond Van Til in his work on self-deception. Van Til says at some point, yeah, this is a problem, and he never really goes and takes on the issue head-on. Well, of course, we talked about it already in this series, and so Bahnsen does spend a lot of time. In fact, his doctoral dissertation is on the issue of self-deception. Okay, so Bahnsen does improve on Van Til. He stands upon his shoulders. Remember the old quote of Newton, you know, if I have seen farther than any man, it's because I've stood on the shoulders of great ones. We can say that about Bahnsen and Van Til. What a great combination, having this great man stand upon the shoulders of another great man. But they perform a very different task. One is seminal, one is kind of wild, you know, in the sense that he has all these ideas and is able to see and penetrate all these different areas. And then somebody comes along and organizes him, moves beyond him in certain ways. So a great combination in God's providence there. The next section in the article is Van Til's understanding of the transcendental argument for God's existence. I'm going to skip over that. And then looking at the next section is Bahnsen's defense of the transcendental argument for God's existence. Now, what I start to do here is give some of the protean objections to the transcendental argument for God's existence, and then offer what Dr. Bahnsen had to say in defense of the transcendental argument, showing that these objections do not work. And I put them in four general categories. One is, if you're following in the book, if you have the book, it's on page 76, and that is one of the criticisms is the nature of the transcendental argument for God's existence. Two is the uniqueness proof for the conclusion of the transcendental argument for God's existence. And by the way, it gets tiring hearing the term transcendental argument for God's existence. So I'm just going to use the word tag. Okay, tag. That's going to be a shorthand. We'll save you some hearing displeasure and me some speaking labor. So he talked about the uniqueness proof for the conclusion of tag, the mere sufficiency 3 of the Christian worldview. I'm going to explain these in a moment just to give you the outline here. The mere sufficiency of the Christian worldview. In other words, this one, the number 2 objection is that there is a lacking a uniqueness proof, right? Though Christianity, the transcendental argument doesn't give us a unique proof that Christianity is true. The second one is that the transcendental argument only shows the mere sufficiency, not the necessity of the Christian worldview. And the fourth one is the move from the conceptual necessity of God's existence to the actual existence of the Christian God. Okay, so these are the four big objections. Now, another objection that I don't deal in here, but I deal with in another little article, is an objection that came up offered by a philosopher named Michael Martin. Now, some of you have heard of Michael Martin. He's written a couple books. One of them is called The Case Against Christianity. And another one is called, I think it's called Atheism, A Philosophical Refutation. Now, Dr. Bahnsen and Dr. Martin were supposed to come into contact, if you know any of the history. They're supposed to debate in Tennessee somewhere. But because of supposedly some disagreement over the tape distribution, Michael Martin backed out of the debate. And so Greg proceeded to show up anyway, lecture on what he was going to do, and then also analyzed Martin's books, and it's a tape seminar you can get from CMF. I think it's called Michael Martin Under the Microscope, so if you're interested in there. But Michael Martin, after Dr. Bahnsen died, I think it was in 1996, wrote an article for some Australian magazine called Tag versus Tang. Clever title. Tag, the transcendental argument for God, versus Tang, T-A-N-G, the transcendental argument for the non-existence of God. And what Michael Martin does there is try to show that logic, science, immorality presuppose the non-existence of God, right? Just the opposite of what Tag sets out to do. Now, I won't go into this. It's not very profound philosophical writing, but I'll give you one example of what he does there. And if you're interested, the article's on my website, and you can look at it there. But he argues that in the case of science, science presupposes the uniformity of nature. We talked about this, right? We agree with this. There must be regularities. But then he says that Christianity undermines that because of our teaching, the Christian worldview's teaching of miracles. Miracles are irregularities. We don't have, therefore, a regular nature, because God at any time can come in and violate, to use his language, the laws of nature. And if that's the case, he argues, how can you have science because you have no real regularity? If God can intervene at any time, how do you know the sun will indeed come out in the west tomorrow, rise in the west, in the east tomorrow? Yeah. It's getting late. So how do you know these things? I'm from California, so we like to think of things revolving around that state. So the objection is supposed to show that without regularity, you can't have science. Christianity doesn't give you regularity, so you have to presuppose the non-existence of God. Now, again, how do we answer this? This is Sunday school stuff, isn't it? How do we answer this? Well, first of all, he doesn't understand the nature of miracles. What is a miracle? Well, here's a bad definition of a miracle. God violating natural laws. Why is that a bad definition? They're his laws, they can do what he wants, right? They're not nature's laws, are they? There is no such thing as nature as a entity, right? It's a reification. You're making a thing. There's nothing wrong talking about nature, just provided we don't think of it as a thing. It's a shorthand way of saying what? The created realm that God providentially regulates, right? Something like that. So there are no natural laws. All laws, in a sense, supernatural. Okay, so God doesn't violate natural laws because there's no natural laws to violate. So he doesn't have an understanding there. Moreover, what is our understanding of, even if we want to use the term natural laws, what is our understanding of them? Well, it's not a deistic understanding where God winds up the clock, right? God winds up the clock, takes his hands back, and watch it go around, and maybe every once in a while has to rewind it again. Okay, that is a deistic conception. That's not a Christian conception. God is involved in everything that comes to pass. Everything that happens is directly from his providential hand. Right? God is the, to use our confessions language, the primary cause. Now, we believe also in secondary causes. And our confession teaches in that section what? That God can work above. There's three ways it says it. God can work above it, against it, and something like in addition to it. What is it? Without it. Without it, above it, and even against it. Okay, his providences. So we make a distinction between providence that is ordinary and providence that is extraordinary. So God's providence that is ordinary is the regular way he causes things to fall out, predictable ways. Not because nature is wound up in a way that he lets go of it, because he covenantally works in certain ways, in an orderly way, predictable way, and therefore we can expect certain things to happen. God is not bound by those, though, his ordinary providence. He can work above, without, and against them. What is his way of working above them, for example? How does God work above ordinary providence? Think of Sarah. Sarah was barren, right? Sarah's an elderly woman. And he works above ordinary providence there, right? It's not extraordinary in one sense that a woman conceives, but that somebody who is barren conceives, he works above ordinary providence. He can work without them. Okay, he can do things that go against providence. He can do what? Stop the sun from moving in the sky, right? Or the earth from rotating on its axis, right? Whatever you want to say it. He can do those types of things. He can go against them, and he can go above them, and he can go without them. He can go against, above, and without these things as extraordinary providences. Now, Michael Martin says, well, God doing that shows that we can't do science. But that's not the case, because primarily God works in an ordinary way. But what about his extraordinary providences? Well, this is a problem only if we have a God who is completely arbitrary, right? I'm just going to perform a miracle. One day I'm going to cause the sun to stand still. Another day I'm going to cause seas to part. Another day I'm going to cause axe heads to float. Another day I'm going to cause donkeys to speak. Okay, some days I'm going to allow, some days you're going to fall through water if you walk on it. Some days you can not fall through water if you walk on it. Okay. Is that our conception, and more importantly, is that the biblical teaching of miracles, that God just arbitrarily does things differently sometimes? What are miracles? They're extraordinary providence for what purpose? For God to display his power. For what purpose? To validate his word, and typically for redemptive historical reasons. Right? When do most miracles occur? In big, redemptive types of periods. What's the most obvious example? Life of Jesus Christ, right? What does Jesus do? Perform miracles. Why? Because God is demonstrating that this is his only begotten Son. He demonstrates it from his conception all the way to the resurrection and ascension. Not everything about Jesus' life is miraculous. Well, not everything he does is a miracle, but miracles punctuate his entire ministry. Previous to that, we have the story of the Exodus, right? Lots of miracles take place there. Other occasions, miracles take place, but they come in a way that God displays his power, typically for a redemptive purpose. It may be exclusively for a redemptive purpose, but I don't want to go beyond what I really know. But it seems like, in most cases, they're for redemptive purpose, to reveal his redemptive will by means of his power to his people or to those that oppose his people. What other things come with miracles? It comes with a theological explanation, right? It comes with a theological explanation. God explains what he does. Why does he open up the seas for the children of Israel? We don't know. He just did it. No, we don't. We do know why he did it. To save his people. To fulfill his promise. He promised Abraham, didn't he, that he would give his children that land. And here you have a fulfillment of his promise. Why did God do it? There's the answer. Right? There's lots of things that we don't know what God did. But somebody may come to me during the break and point out something that I'm missing here. But I can't think of any miracle that we really have no good idea why God did it. They come with some type of explanation, whether it's a broad theological explanation or even a specific explanation. Jesus explains specifically why he performs miracles sometimes. So miracles aren't something that are willy-nilly events that somehow mess up our ability to predict the future or call into question the regularity of God's ordinary providence. So Michael Martin says, well, your worldview allows for miracles to take place. They can happen anytime. How can you get regularity out of that? The answer is what? That's a very poor way, in fact, a false way of characterizing the Christian doctrine of miracles. Okay, first of all, it's not natural law that God violates. Secondly, your conception of miracle is unbiblical. It's pagan. Therefore, you're not offering as a real critique of the Christian position. On the Christian position, God does promise to regulate the world in certain predictable ways. But we also know that God is free to violate those, as our confession says, but he does it for a purpose that is almost always, if not always, explained. And therefore, if that occurs, if when God a miracle occurs and God explains it, then how is it that we can't, that it somehow affects our understanding of the universe, the uniformity of nature? It doesn't, does it? There's no problem there. We don't take those into consideration when we perform our inductions. We always will say that, yes, the sun will rise in the east tomorrow, provided God doesn't perform a miracle. There's no reason to expect it now, but God could do that. But that's not going to affect our normal under our science, because we know that would be an extraordinary providence. And we have accounts for these miracles. So does this undermine our ability to do science? Of course not. Based upon very bad theological mistakes. One of the things that you're going to realize, if you don't realize it already as an apologist, is that most of the attacks on Christianity are based upon not really understanding the Christian worldview. Right? This answer to Michael Martin isn't something that I had to go into modal logic over and show him where his modal modus ponens went bad. Just had to explain to him what Christianity really teaches. And just by explaining it, the objection falls by the board. So that's an objection I don't deal with in here, but that is one of the objections to the transcendental argument. It's actually a clever way of trying to turn the transcendental argument on itself. Now, getting to the other objections. Objection one, the nature of tag. I'm going to do some reading now, so forgive me. The first criticism has to do with the nature of tag. Specifically, some have argued that tag is not a unique argument form, but is reducible to the more traditional arguments for God's existence. Now, anybody that's familiar with this know that this is basically John Frame's contention. John Frame, who is a man that I admire greatly, is a good philosopher, a good theologian. And what I mean by that is we may not always agree with his conclusions, but he's biblical. You know, he always has to wrestle with his arguments. He always tries to bring the Bible into it. He's not a speculative theologian. He's not a philosophical theologian. And so we may agree with John on many issues, but he's almost always worth interacting with. He's not almost always worth agreeing with at the end, but he has some arguments that are worth hearing. So John Frame contends that tag is really a rhetorical argument, no different than the traditional arguments for God's existence. It has some rhetorical advantages over the traditional arguments, but it itself is only rhetorically different. It's not different. It's not different for them, essentially. On page 78, I quote from Frame, Are indirect arguments really distinct from direct arguments? We're calling them transcendental versus traditional. He says direct, which is traditional, and indirect, which is transcendental. Are they really distinct forms? In the final analysis, it doesn't make much difference whether you say causality, therefore God, or with God, no causality, therefore God. Okay, now, what does he mean there? Let's unpack this a little bit. He says, remember the major claim, let's not lose the forest for the trees. His criticism is that tag is great. We like tag. But it's really no different, except in terms of rhetoric, than the traditional arguments. What are the traditional arguments for God's existence? Well, the cosmological, the teleological, and the ontological, and maybe the moral argument you could add in there. Now, if we have time tomorrow, we'll go over these in some detail, but I'm not going to go into these arguments in much detail, just enough to understand this criticism. Now, he goes on to say, it does not make much difference whether you say causality, therefore God, or without God, no causality, therefore God. Okay, so let's write this on the board. Okay, so this is how he puts it. Causality, therefore God, or without God, it's not the case, God, there is no causality. Now, he suppresses the premise, but it's understood, right? But there is causality, therefore God. Without causality, without God, there could be no causality, but we know there is, therefore God. He says there's no difference between those two arguments. Okay, now as they stand, there's something right about that, right? There is no real logical difference. But it's a misunderstanding of the the traditional arguments, I believe, and the transcendental argument. And the misunderstanding is one and the same thing, really. This is supposed to be, by the way, which is supposed to be the indirect or transcendental argument? Which one of these two does John Frame consider to be the transcendental argument? This one, right? And this is supposed to be the traditional argument. Okay. Now, he is thinking of here about a version of the cosmological argument. If you're interested in reading some, this is the Aquinas' second way, I think he's thinking of. And Aquinas' argument is this. There's motion, there's causation. Right? There's causation. Now, if there's causation, there has to be a cause, right? If there are effects, there has to be a cause. But, and this is the dumbed-down version of it, but you cannot have an infinite number of causes, right? If everything has to have a cause, then you have to ask the question, what, given anything, what caused it? Well, he takes as a given that there's no such thing as an uncaused cause. Okay, so there can't be, a self-caused cause. Therefore, there has to, he's going to argue that you can't have an infinite number of these causes, right? Caused by something else. Why not? Because the chain would never get going, right? If, say we're talking about event A. And what is the cause of event A? Well, the cause of event A is B. Well, everything has a cause. What's the cause of that event? Cause C is the cause of B, etc. Now, if you keep on going, then what happens? You have an infinite regress. And Aquinas doesn't like infinite regresses. Bertrand Russell does like them, but that's a different story. Aquinas says you can't have that. So you have to have a first cause, an uncaused cause, and that is God. So given causality, you have to conclude that God exists. Okay, that's the traditional, one of the traditional versions of the cosmological argument in very basic form. Now, the transcendental argument argues like this. Without God, there could be no causation. Or, God is the precondition, or the Christian worldview is the precondition. God is the precondition of causation. Therefore, God must exist. Why? Because there is causation. Right? Remember, what a transcendental argument does, it takes some aspect of our experience. Right? We take that as a given, logic, science, whatever, and then ask what the preconditions to it are. And so, say if there's no God, there's no causality, but there is causality, therefore the transcendental has to be God's existence. Okay, so there is the transcendental argument. Now, Frame says that these are one and the same thing. The same type of argument, only they only differ in terms of the way they're structured. Now, this is a big mistake that he makes, because the logic of the two are very different. And here's the essence of his mistake. This argument takes causality as a given and goes out in the world and looks at causal events. Okay, it's taking causality as a given and showing that once you have causality, you have to have something that is a first cause but is not caused by anything else. Okay, now anybody, the Christian and the non-Christian, can use this argument. Okay, Aristotle, by the way, is certainly not a Christian, used this argument. Okay, not quite in this form, but close enough. Right? And he argues that the conclusion is not God, but what? What does he argue for? The unmoved mover. The unmoved mover. So because there's causality, because there cannot be an infinite number of causal connections, there has to be an unmoved mover, an uncaused cause. Okay, this is an argument used by Christians or non-Christians. What it takes as given is that we perfectly understand we have a right to use the notion of causality. Given that we experience causality and see it, what are the implications of it? Now, this argument here is asking a different question altogether. This argument is asking what you can call, to violate my rule, a de jure question. A question of, this is sometimes a legal term, right? De jure, a question of right. And it's opposed to what? De facto, right? Some things may happen de facto that shouldn't happen de jure. They happen in fact, but they don't happen by right. This is asking a de jure question. By what right does the unbeliever have to utilize the notion of causation? And our argument isn't not given causation in your understanding of it. What are the implications of it? Given causation, what can we conclude from it? But it's rather, by what right do you, the unbeliever, have to use the concept of causation? And the argument goes that you don't have any right. The only way that you can make sense of or provide the preconditions of causation is the God of the Bible. And therefore, God must exist. Given that there is causation, God necessarily exists. So again, what's the difference? This is taking the notion of causation as a given and seeing what the implications are. This is asking the de jure question, by what right does the unbeliever have to utilize or use the notion of causation? And it's saying that he doesn't have any right to it. He doesn't have any right to it. So you could see that the inner workings of these two arguments are misconstrued by this criticism. And because this misconstrues the transcendental argument, it shows that this criticism fails. Okay? They're not talking about the same thing. The causality here may be talking about the same causality here, but that different questions are asked of them. This is one that's a given. This is one we're asking a question of right. So John Frame doesn't offer us a good criticism. Now, I go into much more details than this, but this is the basic problem with John Frame's criticism. Now, what's humorous is that Greg Bahnsen actually addressed this issue down at Westminster Theological Seminary in California to John Frame's class with John Frame sitting there. And before we went to breakfast, and he said, how does John miss this? Right? This doesn't seem very difficult. Why does John miss this? And so we went to speculate. And, you know, John Frame is very ecumenical, and he wants to see the church, you know, not emphasize the differences, but come together in common community to fight the real enemy. So he's very ecumenical-minded, tries to be as open-minded as possible, charitable. But still, I think that's scratching her head. And I said, well, it's like Wittgenstein once said, for a mistake, that's too big. For a mistake, that's just too big. Now, if you know Dr. Bahnsen, he's not afraid to say anything. And so, during his presentation to John Frame's class and John Frame there, he says, John, for a mistake, this is too big. I thought, oh, no, I shouldn't have told him that. But it's true, isn't it? This is a mistake that is hard to understand. Okay, so this is not a good criticism of the transcendental argument for God's existence. The other ones are at least on the face of it a little better. So if you're looking in the Festschrift, look on page 82, the second objection. This has to do with the uniqueness proof for the conclusion of tag. Now, I know this is after lunch, and some of you don't like more heavy-duty philosophy. This isn't really heavy-duty, but it's heavier than you'll like, so I apologize. But we're going to plug on. This is for posterity. The uniqueness proof for the conclusion of tag. Another criticism against tag is that the conclusion, God exists, does not necessarily follow from the premises. This criticism has taken many forms, including one made by John Warwick Montgomery. And he claims the following. Even Van Til's trenchant decimations of non-Christian positions are rendered ineffective by his ultimate presuppositionalism, since all the non-Christians whom Van Til chooses to criticize, could employ his own two-edged sword against him, crying, oh, Montgomery, you're so dramatic, right? Not saying, but crying, such criticisms are irrelevant for right reason. True interpretation of fact and genuine application of the standards of consistency begin with commitment to my presuppositional starting point. And even if it were possible in some fashion to destroy all existent alternative worldviews but that of Orthodox Christianity, the end result would still not be the necessary truth of Christianity. For in a contingent universe, there is an infinite number of possible philosophical positions. And even the fallaciousness of infinity minus one positions would not establish the validity of the one that remained, unless we were to introduce the gratuitous assumption that at least one had to be right. Okay, there's several criticisms here. The first one we're going to ignore, and that is people can turn this around upon us. Right? One of the criticisms that I'm not going to deal with is we say, well, you don't understand the Christian worldview the right way. This is how you understand it. Well, why can't the non-Christian worldview say the same thing? You're not understanding why we criticize the empiricist. We said that he has contradicted himself. All knowledge comes through sense experience, but what? But that piece of knowledge, that all knowledge comes through sense experience. Contradiction. Now, when people show a contradiction in the Christian worldview, what do we say? You're not understanding Christianity right, right? You have to presuppose Christianity. Think of it from our point of view. And so Montgomery is here saying, well, why can't they do the same thing? You're not understanding us right. Right? You have to presuppose our things. But see, this is a fairly shallow criticism because what do we say? Okay, then, if we're misunderstanding you, keep going. We're listening. Right? We're on your ground now. Keep talking. Okay, so this isn't a good criticism. Now, there might be some way to rescue this criticism at another level, but it's just not a fair evaluation of our position. We're not saying that we take them. It's basically, in one sense, accusing us of taking cheap shots, right? We'll take you so far and listen, but then we're going to interpret you according to the way we want to interpret you. Now, another way you can understand this criticism is to say, like we do, when we come to certain issues, like, why did God ordain evil? And what's our answer? We don't know. Well, why can't non-believers do the same thing? How do you justify all knowledge coming through sense experience, and this piece of knowledge not coming through sense experience? We don't know. It's a mystery. It's a mystery. Right now, if we're allowed mysteries, why isn't the unbeliever allowed mysteries? Well, that sounds pretty good when you first hear it, right? Well, yeah, with sauce for the goose and sauce for the gander. If we can appeal to mysteries, then why can't they? What's the answer to that? Because mysteries are not contradictions, right? We don't know all about God in his known nature, God in his decree, right? There's many things we don't know, but it never turns out to be something that can be proven to be contradictory. You know, I don't even like the word paradoxical, but you can call it a paradox. How can God ordain whatsoever comes to pass, and yet we still have free will? Good question. When you have the answer, write an essay, and I will listen to it, right? We don't know. How does God do that? We don't know how God does that. What we do know is that we can formulate it in such a way, go beyond a little of what I said now, and understand it as so as to not to be contradictory. It's a mystery, isn't it? It's a mystery. Many things about God are a mystery. But there's no contradiction there, unless you do what? You import it into it, non-Christian teaching. Then you can show that it's contradictory. But that's not interesting because that's not the Christian worldview. But now we take the empiricist. Why can't he appeal to mystery? All knowledge comes through sense experience, but not all knowledge comes through sense experience. Contradiction. No mystery. Well, what's wrong with that? Well, first of all, God ordaining whatsoever comes to pass in free will is not A and not A, is it? Okay, it's not an example of A and not A. Here's an example of A and not A. There's no mystery and a contradiction. Contradictions are not mysterious. They are open, lucid, clear, and obviously false. Secondly, there is no room for mystery in an empiricist worldview, is there? There is no absolute personal being that is beyond our thoughts. Right? And even if you wanted to say, well, the universe, but still, in principle, according to the empiricist, there's nothing ultimately mysterious. Everything is open, laid bare, at least in principle, to human understanding. So there is no room for mystery in empiricism. So however you want to read John Warwick Montgomery here, it's a very poor criticism of Vantillianism. But his other criticism is a little more interesting. His second criticism is that, look, you've gone and refuted it. We agree with you. You've refuted the Buddhist, the Muslim. You've refuted the Jew. You refuted the communist. You refuted the Darwinist. He refuted all these views. However, that doesn't prove the Christian worldview, does it? Right. As far as it stands, you're right. Therefore, you lack a uniqueness proof. All you've done is shown that Christianity is a possibly true worldview. You haven't shown it is necessarily true. And so your claim that tag shows the certainty of God's existence is exaggerated. It doesn't do that. It shows the possibility, not the necessity. Okay, now as it stands, that's interesting criticism, right? And so far as it goes, if this is all we knew about the transcendental argument, it would be a legitimate criticism. But is that as far as it goes, and is that what Vantillianism really is about? That's what really we really claim. Well, this is a good criticism, as we'll find out tomorrow, against Clarkianism, but not against Vantillianism. Okay, why is that? Why is that? Well, let's first of all look at his last statement in parentheses. He says, even if you refute it, every worldview but Christianity, that doesn't establish Christianity because, he says here, unless we were to introduce the gratuitous assumption that at least one had to be right. Well, Montgomery is a historian, not a philosopher, and this is a big philosophical mistake. If there are 10 possibilities and we refute it 9 of them, what does that mean about the 10th one? What does that imply? If there's 10 explanations, and I'm talking about not 10 explanations that we can come up with, but if there's 10 explanations that are possible for an event, 10 possible, and it's exhaustive, 10 exhaustive explanations for any given event, and we can exclude 9 of them, what does that tell us about the last one? That is the right one. Right? It's the right one. That doesn't mean if we can think of a half a dozen explanations and show that 5 of them are wrong, that the 6th one is right. It means that if you exhaustively give all the possible explanations and disprove all of them but one, you prove the one remaining. Yeah, this is a mistake. So he's confusing what human beings could put forward in possible language, right? In modal logic, this is a mistake. In modal logic, if you eliminate all possibilities but one, you've shown that the one remaining is A. If all the other ones are impossible, you prove that the remaining one is not only true, but it's what? Necessary. Necessary. This is a mistake, and this is going to be the heart of his mistake. But this conception, first of all, is that he thinks that presuppositionalism, the transcendental argument, teaches that we refute other worldviews one by one by one by one by one, and that we are left, right? The last man standing. We're the gunslinger, and we shot all the other gunslingers, and now we are the last one standing. That's not our argument. Our argument is the possibility of the contrary, that Christianity and Christianity alone provides the necessary preconditions. He's forgetting what? The second step. I'm assuming he's being charitable. He's forgetting. He may be ignorant. I don't know. But he doesn't realize the second step. He's only talking about the first step. The first step is what? Answer a fool according to his folly. We take their worldview and destroy it. Okay, that's not where we leave it, though, is it? That's not where we leave it. We then go invite them to the Christian worldview and show that we have an explanation. And then we show that it's the only one. Now, we haven't talked about this much, but how do we show it's the only one? Well, the term that Vantil uses is the impossibility of the contrary, but we show that given a triune, personal, absolute God who reveals himself in Scripture, we can explain that. And if you deny any one of those things, that you have you don't have any ability to explain things. In other words, this is at least a claim to uniqueness proof. The transcendental argument for God's existence at least claims to have a uniqueness proof, the impossibility of the contrary. Let's look at it this way. If you have, we talked about half a dozen or a dozen possibilities. Let's just talk about two possibilities. Christianity and non-Christianity. Okay? Here are the two possibilities, right? We've talked about the antithesis. All non-Christian worldviews are what we call what? What did Brahms do with the work of Haydn? By the way, I love Haydn, but Brahms' work on Haydn is almost miraculous, the Haydn variations. We have variations on a theme here, okay? The non-Christian theme. What they share in common is what's most important. Yes, they differ, but on unessential points. They all are in agreement that there's no triune God of Scripture. There's no absolute personal being. There's no revelation of God in Scripture, etc. So there is an antithesis between Christianity and all non-Christian worldviews. Now, when we refute the non-Christian worldview, we are indeed the last man standing, aren't we? There's no other possibility. If you have A or not A, right, one of them has to be true. Either I am 6 feet tall, or what? I am not 6 feet tall. Now, you may not believe it, but sorry, that's your problem, right? One of those is true. One of those is true. You take contradictory statements. If one of them is shown to be false, then the other one is true. Now, here's a point. When we do an internal critique, we're not critiquing non-Christianity, typically. We're critiquing naturalistic Darwinism. We're critiquing Buddhism. We're critiquing Judaism. And so we're not really refuting non-Christianity. We're refuting one version of it. Ah, yes, but it's a variation on the theme. The same basic criticisms that we'll give to the Buddhist are the same basic criticisms we're going to give to the Muslim or the secular humanist. Variations on a theme. Okay, because the same essential ingredients are agreed upon by all non-Christian philosophies. And it's easier to talk about a specific version, right? When you're actually engaged in an apologetic conversation, it's helpful to talk about their version of non-Christianity, right? Or if you're writing about it, you write about a particular version of non-Christianity. And so it is an instance of a type. When you refute naturalistic Darwinism, that is an instance of a type of non-Christian religion. And so, yes, we are only looking at one single variation, but we are refuting the instance as an example of the refutation of the type. And so Warwick Montgomery doesn't understand, first of all, what a uniqueness proof constitutes, but he also doesn't understand the nature of the transcendental argument. Okay, so this is a bad criticism. Montgomery's criticism doesn't understand, really, what Van Til is claiming. Did I see that we had a 10... did you wave your hand earlier, Aubrey?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought I saw you. Okay, time to stop.